Good morning. Thanks so much for coming this morning to our frameworks on diagnostics and the future of your health. I'm really excited to have Roche Diagnostics presenting this really interesting information. As a former Roche alum, I love to see them telling about all the wonderful things that they're doing up on the North Seats side of Indianapolis. So as you guys probably know, we tell this all the time, Indiana has a $63 billion life sciences industry that's made up of the pharmaceutical and biotech industries, medical device and testing, ag biosciences, but they couldn't sell any of those products without diagnostics, because without the diagnostic to tell what's wrong, you can't do implant a medical device or administer a drug or therapeutic treatment. So what they do is critically important, not just for healthcare, but also for our overall economic health in the state. And I'm really excited to introduce John Osiki. Dr. Osiki is the Director of Medical and Scientific Affairs for Molecular Diagnostics at Roche Diagnostics Corporation. He spoke at our Life Sciences Summit last year in our scientific session and had such a great presentation that we wanted to sort of deliver that and then some to a broader audience. So we're really grateful to have him here this morning, as well as some other of his colleagues from Roche to give us some updates on what's going on in the fields of point-of-care testing as well as molecular diagnostics. John is one of our net import talents, so we talk a lot about talent in the life sciences industry and getting more talent to the state, and so he came from Roche Molecular in California, so we're really happy to have him now in Indiana and building his team and doing some great work in the field of diagnostics that's going to affect healthcare really globally. So, John, I will let you take it away.
All right, so we're going to do a mic check first and make sure you can hear me. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the program today. It's exciting for us to be here and share a little bit about our passion for diagnostics. Roche is quite a large company. There's a nice brochure that they have on the seats that I think you'll find a lot of interesting facts. I'm going to start with a little bit of information about the company and share some details with you. And then the real purpose that I'm here today is to talk to you about antibiotic resistance. It's a problem, an issue in healthcare that has, it's really a tremendous burden on the healthcare system. We all have family, neighbors, friends that interact with the healthcare system, and antibiotic resistance is a real issue, and it's going to become an even bigger issue in the future if we don't identify some pathways to prevent infections and identify some solutions from a diagnostics perspective. So what I'm going to do is tell a story today about some history that's led us up to where we are today and some innovative solutions that could solve some of these problems in the future. And so just a few facts about Roche. Roche is actually based in Basel, Switzerland. So if you're familiar with Switzerland, it's sort of the northern part of Switzerland, very close to France. It's interesting, when we go there for meetings, sometimes you have to stay in France because you can't find a hotel room in Basel. It's that close to France. There's a small town there. It's quite a small town, though, and the organization as a whole, this is from our annual report a couple years back, over 92,000 employees worldwide, so it's quite a huge endeavor, the organization. We used to be in some different areas like flavors and fragrances and vitamins. They've sold off all of those parts of the business and really focusing now on healthcare. And we're really interested in developing new diagnostic strategies and therapeutics for patients for the future. And so that's really where we're focused in healthcare. And it actually creates some unique opportunities for us to have both the drug development side as well as the diagnostic side, as we're able to introduce companion diagnostics, go through those clinical trials, and be able to do both in an excellent way. So just to give you an idea from a pharmaceutical perspective, Roche has been providing medicines for many years, over 100 years. We've been in this business, and this just gives you a feeling. For 2015, there were 25 million patients that received a pharmaceutical solution from Roche. But if we think about diagnostics from a diagnostic perspective, this is such an important part of patient management. And in 2015, there were 15 billion tests that were performed on Roche equipment. And what you can see in this image, hopefully you can see that, this is your typical clinical laboratory, sort of clinical chemistry setting. We do lots of types of testing on automated systems. A lot of that's quite simple. You know, we're looking for a specific biomarker and its concentration in blood or urine, different sample types. Sarah Mosley is going to speak to you today. Myself, we represent molecular diagnostics, and molecular is a little bit more sophisticated. What we do, we'll take a sample, a patient sample, and we're trying to identify the genetic signature of a pathogen or a mutation that might be present in your genetic material that would reflect your ability to respond to a drug for, you know, preventing the development of cancer. And so the molecular diagnostics approach is a little bit more sophisticated. We rely on enzymes and chemistries to really develop results. And it requires a little bit more planning, a little bit more oversight, really, from a laboratory perspective, rather than just trying to detect the amount of glucose in urine or something that's simple like that. So I wanted to start. We're going to go back. I'm going to tell you this is sort of a history lesson, I think, that I find fascinating. We're going to go back to World War I. There was a young gentleman from Europe, from the UK, actually, that was quite a good rifleman, but he was also a microbiologist, and he was deployed with a medical unit, and he was helping when soldiers were injured. He would help bring them back into the hospital setting, and he was observing how they were being treated and managed. And so you can imagine with a wound during World War I, if that wound was infected, pretty good chance you were going to die. Well, they had antiseptic agents at that time, and they knew that they could kill these microorganisms that were causing disease and illness. But one of the issues was that when they treated with these antiseptics, oftentimes they did more damage to the patient than they actually resolved. So many times those patients would go on to progress with lots of morbidity and eventually leading to mortality. So this young gentleman said, there has to be a better way. There has to be another solution. And the individual I'm talking about, this is Alexander Fleming. So he's the gentleman that discovered penicillin. And if you haven't heard this story before, it's actually quite remarkable. He, after seeing these patients in pain and agony, right, suffering these wounds, he thought, this is my life's work. I'm going to figure out a way, you know, that we can keep these organisms from causing infection and disease without damaging host tissues and allowing these individuals to recover through their immune system and rebuild. And so what he did, he dedicated his life to studying microorganisms. So he would grow Staphylococcus aureus. A third of us carry this organism in our nose. The thing that's quite remarkable about staph is that it carries this armamentarium of genes that can be expressed at any given time. And it can, I tell my children about this, wash your hands, you know, make sure you stay clean, because this organism can literally dissolve bone. It can dissolve connective tissue. It can eat through our entire body. But we have this healthy relationship with Staph aureus such that it doesn't cause disease or infection except when there's an opportunity. And so if you think about individuals in healthcare settings where you have damage to tissues, it's exposed, you know, folks in war settings where they have trauma, these organisms can get into places where they don't belong and they can cause infections and flourish. And so Alexander Fleming was really focused on being able to figure out a way that they could prevent, we could prevent these types of organisms from causing infection and disease. And so, like all good Europeans, as I learned in my previous global role, Alexander Fleming took the month of August for a holiday, and he would leave the laboratory. And he was renowned for being a pretty messy guy. Like, he wouldn't keep his papers organized. His lab was a mess. He left the lab with all of his culture plates on the bench, and the window was open. He came back a month later, and he observed that his Staph aureus plates, where he had grown a lawn of organisms, so it was completely covered, a fungus had blown into the window, landed on the plate, and created a zone of clearing. And so what he observed was something like this. I'm not sure how well you can see this in the back, but this is a streak, basically, of the bacterium here, and then the fungus, and you can see this zone of clearing where the organism won't grow. So he identified the fact that this fungus can prevent bacteria from growing, And this was a huge moment because if we can harvest whatever this material is and administer it, we could prevent bacterial infections. And that's where penicillin came from. Essentially, there are many organisms, fungal organisms, that produce these antibiotics that we've been able to harness and use for medications. And so one thing that was really interesting, so this is what he discovered many, many years ago in clinical laboratories. So I was in a clinical lab in New York, and this is what we did at the bench. When people came in with illness, we would recover. So let's say you took a nasal swab and you would streak that out. You would have many organisms because we carry lots of bacteria. We would identify what we thought was a pathogen, and then we would streak it out again on an auger plate like this, create a lawn, and then we drop these little paper discs that have drugs on them, and those drugs would diffuse through the auger plates, and it would create a zone of clearing, and that would tell us that these organisms were resistant. We've been using this technology forever. This is still sort of the standard in a lot of clinical laboratories that are being used today. And what we've noticed is that there are organisms that are resistant. So you might be able to see some little dots here. You get a zone of clearing. Most of the organisms are susceptible. They'll die when they're exposed to the drug. But we're also finding that there's this evolution of resistance. And so Fleming knew about resistance back then, and it makes a lot of sense. It's sort of evolution. These organisms want to live. And so in the presence of antibiotics, they can trade genes with other organisms, and they can come, you know, go on to be resistant. And that's what you see here are these little satellite colonies. So imagine this in a patient. When we go into the healthcare setting and we over-prescribe drugs, then we're selecting for these resistant organisms that we pass on to our family members and friends, and then these go on to cause infections and disease. So we know this is a big issue. This is an issue of The Economist that came out not too long ago, and they are talking here, this is from 2016, about the dangerous rise of antibiotic resistance. What does that mean from an economic impact on a global scale? So we know that we're pouring tons of antibiotics into our food products. We're pouring them into our cattle and swine herds to prevent infections. And so ultimately, this paints sort of a dismal picture about how uncontrolled this is becoming and how important it is that we identify some new pathways to control these organisms. Okay, so now I'm going to take you back to my childhood. I'm actually from St. Louis originally. We moved to California, and I was sad because my children never saw lightning bugs. There are no lightning bugs in California. Did you know that? I guess because it's the desert, they don't live there. And I recall as a child, there were research studies that were going on in the Midwest. They were capturing lightning bugs because they were studying this mechanism. They wanted to try to understand how is it that lightning bugs make light. And what we know now, it's actually quite simple. The reaction, it's an enzyme that's present in the tail of the lightning bug. And there is a molecule that gets turned over when you have energy and oxygen. It gets turned over and produces light. So it's actually quite simple of a reaction that we know that now. But it's found in nature, and it's actually quite simple. And so what I want to teach you about today is this new technology where we can harness, we can use the light through this simple process to help us understand antibiotic resistance. Okay? So this is the background on essentially the chemical mechanism. One thing that's really unique about this mechanism is that it doesn't have a lot of waste associated with it. There's no heat necessarily that's lost. It's much more efficient than like an incandescent light or an LED light. And it's quite a remarkable sort of scientific discovery now that we understand the details. Okay, so now I'm going to shift a little bit, and we're going to talk about another story in history. This is the Ganges River, if you've ever been to India before. This is quite a famous river. It's one of the largest in the world. By volume, I think it's number 3 of the amount of water that flows through the Ganges. And this is renowned for, it's believed to be a sacred river by the Hindus, and it has healing properties. It's always known to have these healing properties. And legend tells that there was a god that came down to earth and return to heaven, and this is the pathway by which we can return to heaven. So there's a belief amongst the Hindu people that this water has cleansing properties, and that it's the way that we return back to heaven. And so there's a lot of cultural experience with the water from this river, where individuals will put their deceased into the river or the remains of their deceased as a pathway to return, and it's known to have healing properties. And so there was a gentleman, another gentleman from England, Sir Ernest Hanbury Hinken. He was a microbiologist that was studying in the late 1800s, early 1900s, trying to understand cholera and bacterial infections. And he was studying the Ganges River because he had heard about the healing properties, and he wanted to understand what was it about this river that could prevent infections. And so he went there to study, and what he found was if he took bacteria, generally what you would have to do is boil water to sterilize bacteria. And what he would find is if he took a culture of bacteria and he added water from the Ganges to this bacteria, it would kill the bacteria within 3 hours. So there's some antibacterial property associated with this water, and he was trying to understand and identify what it was. And so, to make a long story short, basically what he found was there is something present in this water, and it's actually what we know today as a bacteriophage. So it's a virus that infects bacteria and will destroy bacteria. So if you go and you bathe in this water, or you're exposed to these bacteriophages, they're actually helping prevent disease by eliminating bacteria. So it's almost like a viral infection of bacteria that can kill them. So what's unique about this is now we understand that these particles can be harnessed as a tool to deliver genetic material. So these viral particles are trying to reproduce themselves, and in so doing, they kill the bacteria. We can now harness these viral particles to introduce novel genes and use them to combat antibiotic-resistant organisms. Okay, so now I'm going to introduce you to this new technology. It's called SMARTicles technology. And this was a really innovative approach to understanding bacterial resistance. So when I showed you the plate, that we had to streak out the plate with the organisms and then put the little discs on there to understand antibiotic resistance, that takes days. So most organisms take, I would say, at least 9 hours to grow on a culture plate. You have to grow the specimen out, then identify the pathogens you're interested in, and a lot of microbiologists can identify them by sight, but to do resistance testing, it takes quite a bit of time. So 2 to 3 days is typically what it takes to turn that around. Lots of different technologies have tried to address this problem and shorten that time frame so that we could have those results immediately. And that's a bit of a challenge because we have mixed flora. You have lots of different organisms in your nose. We have normal flora organisms that may be on our skin that carry resistance mechanisms, but they're not pathogenic to us. So if you put all of these organisms together, it's really important to know that the resistance genes we're interested in are in the pathogens we're concerned about. And so that's why this technology is so important. It combines the firefly luciferase with our understanding of genetic targets and pathogens to be able to generate a test that gives us a result in 4 hours. So we can take a sample from a patient, put it through this process, and it can give us a result within 4 hours and tell us about viability and resistance to different drugs. And so we basically have this pathogen-specific bioparticle, and this is very similar to a bacteriophage. So imagine if we're trying to understand Staph aureus, we have bacteriophages that are very specific to Staph aureus that can bind to those. And these bioparticles are engineered such that they don't have the genetic capability to reproduce themselves in these clinical samples. They simply carry genetic material that's synthetic, that we've engineered, that we've designed to express this luciferase gene, to express the enzyme that can produce light. And so what we do is we take this genetic DNA, we put it inside this pathogen-specific bioparticle delivery system, and then we can introduce this to a clinical specimen. And if we're looking at enteric bacterial pathogens, or we're looking at Staph aureus that may be on the surface, of our skin, or maybe even tuberculosis from the lung, we can tailor these bioparticles to specifically bind and introduce genetic material into these organisms. And so this is how it works. Essentially, this is a bacterial organism. That's the genetic material. That circle that you see here is the bacterial genome. And what we do is we introduce these bioparticles that bind very specifically to the target of interest, and there's a cell surface specificity. It's sort of like a neighborhood. There are proteins on the surface of Staph aureus that are only on those organisms, and so there's very specific binding that will bring the pathogen in contact with our bioparticle. Then we introduce the genetic material. And again, this is that natural mechanism that bacteriophages use in the Ganges River, right, to eliminate bacteria. And so once that genetic material is introduced, then we take advantage of our knowledge of the genetic structure of these pathogens, and we express genes, very specific genes, inside that organism. Now, in order for that to happen, the organism has to be fit. It has to be alive. It has to be successful in its environment. And so we know that it's viable if it's expressing these genes. And then what we do is we've generated a bunch of proteins that accumulate inside the cell, and then we introduce our substrate. So this is what causes the reaction to turn over and generate light. And so that's just like, imagine the firefly being able to turn on and off its signaling mechanism. By adding the substrate, we complete the equation, basically, and are able to generate a signal through this process. And so basically what this does, it gives us a true measure of organism response to antibiotics. Now imagine if you took a clinical specimen and you placed it in antibiotics and then you introduced these bioparticles. If you got no signal, then the organism's either not present or it's dead because it doesn't have the viability to turn over these different signals. And so this is, again, just an overview. So now if we take the clinical sample, our specific smarticle that we're interested in, and our antibiotic of interest, and we combine them all in one tube, and we incubate that on our system for about 4 hours. We can read the system after we add the substrate, and if there's no light at all, then we know that the organism's either dead or that the resistance mechanism isn't present because it was destroyed. But if we do produce light, then we're able to see that there is resistant organism present because of the way the bioparticles are set up. So it's quite a remarkable approach. And as I mentioned, one of the challenges that we face right now, clinical colleagues are making decisions based on clinical presentation. They're trying to determine whether or not our patients are infected, and they're worried about antimicrobial resistance, but they want to be careful. They want to err on the side of caution. And so there's a lot of over-prescribing that occurs right now in ill patients. And so what this technology will allow us to do is within 4 hours to have a definitive identification as well as a definitive resistance, understanding of resistance patterns, and be able to tailor these treatments. And so if you think about patients in general, we're all different, right? We all have different genetic backgrounds. We all have different diets. We have different environments that we come from, and so we're exposed to different organisms and have different normal flora. We're all exposed to different antibiotics from time to time. If you have children with ear infections or, you know, yourself taking antibiotics or exposed to elderly folks that are interacting with long-term care, we all have different types of exposures. And so what this allows us to do is personalize healthcare, and I think that's really what the future is about. It's about personalizing, you know, and tailoring treatments and medications to patients in their time of need and avoiding unnecessary use of antibiotics. And I think, yeah, so that was my last slide. I actually took my full 20 minutes. So do we want to take a couple questions, or do we want to go ahead and turn over to the next speaker? Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Corinne. Corinne Fonts is a colleague that works with me at Roche, and she is laser-focused on point-of-care testing, which is a little bit different. I showed you the clinical lab space. We have these huge mega machines that are completely automated that run samples through, and they're very efficient. They do a great job, and Corinne is an expert in that as well from a clinical chemistry perspective, but what she's focused on now is point-of-care, moving that technology away from the laboratory and placing it right next to the patient, so that we can generate results and really have a great impact on patient care. So I'm going to turn it over to Corinne.
Thanks, John.
Yep, absolutely.
So you guys can hear me okay? Okay. Well, it's good to be here. I'm going to talk about point-of-care testing, which is, I think, one of the most exciting areas of laboratory medicine. When I was first out of training, I was handed this opportunity to do take on point-of-care testing, to be the director of point-of-care testing at a large academic medical center. And I was so excited. I was like, yeah, I'll totally do this. And then I started talking to my colleagues, and they're like, are you sure you want to do that? That is the wild, wild west, and it is out of control, and you are going to be, you know, up to here in all kinds of problems. And so I was a little nervous, but then I said, okay, I'm going to take it on and see what really this is all about. What I found out was the clinicians were really desperate for information. They wanted to know the answer, to be able to help their patient as soon as possible. And they didn't want to wait for their samples to be collected and sent to the lab that was sometimes miles away from them. Or even in another city, the sample had to get on a plane and go to Utah to be tested. And so they were just desperate for any kind of objective information that could help confirm or, you know, dismiss the diagnosis that they were thinking of in their individual patient. So it's a really exciting time. But on the flip side, you know, I also learned some things about people not reading directions, finding ways around how to do quality control. So my relationship with manufacturers was really interesting, saying, I'm going to give this device to my point-of-care coordinator, and she is going to figure out how to bypass all of your ways to make this instrument do quality control, which was also a lot of fun because the clinician colleagues that I worked with were very clever. And if there was a way to save time, they figured out how to do that, and one of the ways was to not do quality control. So we've come a long way in point-of-care testing. I've been doing it a while, but actually, the first examples of point-of-care testing was in the Egyptian community, where the women that they suspected to be pregnant, they would have them urinate on wheat and barley. And if it sprouted, she was pregnant. Didn't sprout, not pregnant. If you sprouted wheat, you were more likely to have a female. If you sprouted barley, a boy. And this actually was repeated in the scientific community, you know, years later, and is found to be 70% accurate. So it's pretty, you know, decent test. We have, you know, much, you know, worse point-of-care tests out there today on the market. And so 70% sensitivity, it's all right, especially back during this time. But, you know, one of the things that wasn't was fast. It took a long time for the, you know, wheat and barley to sprout. So, we've come a long way, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about what we do today. When a patient enters the clinic or the hospital, they'll have some sort of assessment by the physician. They'll get a history and physical, and most of the diagnosis, or at least their differential, can be made just through that process. When they don't know, they'll start collecting some blood specimens, and we call that a rainbow. Sometimes you'll get this whole rainbow of blood collection tubes, and just for your information, there's just different additives in each one of those tubes, and they maybe make plasma or serum, or they have certain compounds in there that make it easier to do testing on when it comes to the clinical laboratory. So when that test goes to the laboratory, it's coming from, they can come from all different sites. So you have these outlying clinics, and as we've consolidated healthcare, we've formed these what we call mega labs. They may be a mega lab within an institution. So if you think of a large academic center, you have one big hospital site, they have a huge lab. And John talked about Roche instruments performing 15 billion tests a year. These hospital systems perform millions of tests per year. So the hospital system that I worked at, we did over 5 million tests per year in our one system. And so that was made up of not only our hospitalized patients, but all these clinics that were from, you know, 40, 50 miles outside of our area. And we had the centralized testing unit to save money, essentially. You know, the more you do, the lower the cost. But what that creates is an environment where physicians have to wait for their test results, and they can't respond quickly to really simple problems that can be addressed and then not, you know, dealt with at that time and not have to worry about patients coming back, or you'll never see them again and they don't get the right treatment. So a mega lab might look something like this. And you can see there's not a lot of natural light. Okay, so these labs are typically in the basement or in some industrial park far away from everybody. They have complex machines, and they do, you know, some of the instruments can do 100 tests on a single platform. And so they're really complex. But what we're talking about with point of care is shifting all of that down to the simple. So to have it in a single kit or box where you can put it at the patient's bedside and get that result immediately. But if you see this person here, she's highly trained. She's gone to med tech school, usually 2 to 4 years, and she has years of experience doing blood banking, chemistry, micro, and she understands pre-analytic laboratory error. She understands the transcription post-analytic errors of putting those results out to the clinicians and making sure that there's no transcription problems when they get the results. She understands when there may be an interference present based on the sample being collected in the wrong tube, right? So just for example, what we saw in the core lab a lot of times is when a clinician draws a sample in the wrong tube, realizes it, pops the top, and pours it into the other one. And then you say, well, this purple top tube has EDTA in it, which chelates calcium and potassium, and there's no way, it's potassium EDTA, so it chelates the calcium, and your potassium's 15, which, you know, upper limit of normal is around 5.5. So no way your calcium is 15, you'd be dead. And then, or your potassium, and then your calcium is like at the floor, it's zero, and your calcium's tightly controlled, and it needs to be between, you know, 8 and 10. And so if it's 2, we know that you poured the sample into this other test tube. So the med techs know this kind of stuff. And they have a lot of computer systems around them to help identify errors when there may be one present. At the point of care, you don't have that. You have an untrained, no laboratory experience whatsoever. They have a magic machine or box in front of them that gives them a result, and they say that that is the word of God, and that's what that result is, no matter how many times they've dropped it or dunked it in bleach or, you know, done all of these things that you can do to a point-of-care test. So that's the environment that we're working in, but you can see the pressures on the system to get a laboratory result to a clinician quickly are much lower when you're in this kind of environment versus a decentralized opportunity. So you can think about accident scenes, right? Outlying clinics where you might be the only doctor within 100 miles. How do you treat patients in that kind of situation? So decentralized testing is not like the overall solution, but it can complement these mega lab environments that we're generating with all the consolidation that's going on in laboratory medicine today. So one example might be at an accident scene where you have a, 25-year-old woman who has been in a car crash and she's broken some ribs and she might have to have a CT of her abdomen. You want to know if that person's pregnant before you do that because radiation can cause some damage. And, do you want her to wait around for an hour or two for the phlebotomist to come collect the sample, send it to the lab, and then find out later that, you know, no, she's not pregnant, we're going to go ahead and take her on to surgery. So that's one example. You might even want, maybe her father's driving by the accident scene and has a heart attack and drops there in the street. You want to have access to a troponin at the point of care, right, so that you can see how much heart damage. So by the time they arrive, this individual arrives at the hospital, they can start treatment right away. They've got some kind of objective data to know what's going on with the patient. Well, urgent situations are one thing, but another might be you're at a clinic, and physicians have often complained that patients lie, and actually women do this more often than men, curiously. So it's about 25% of patients are not completely truthful with their providers, and women are average around 30%. So if you're having a conversation with your physician, you might be embarrassed about some of the issues that you have going on, or you might not want to be totally honest that you eat jelly donuts every night even though you have diabetes, but they're so good. And so, the clinician wants to have some tests to be able to have that face-to-face conversation with their clinician, say, hey, just got your test results, and maybe you're not eating, green beans and bell peppers every night for a snack. Maybe you're snacking on that jelly donut that we've talked about. So stop eating the jelly donut. And that is so much more effective to have that conversation face-to-face than calling that patient a week later saying, I got your test results, and maybe you haven't been completely honest, because patients don't answer the phone. They might not come back. So there's a number of challenges in communicating those kinds of results to patients. So if you had an instrument that you could have in your office and do that testing right there, you can save a lot of heartache having for the patient to wait, the anxiety of getting that test result back. Drug testing is another one where you want to have tests back quickly. And there are some challenges around that as well we'll talk about in a minute. So the hurdles for point-of-care testing, as I've kind of outlined, that we have really untrained users. We have complex tests in the laboratory that we're trying to simplify down so that anybody can do it without making a mistake and without causing harm by not following the directions of the test, and have that sample type be something that is easy to collect, non-invasive preferably, and without very little sample preparation. So there are a few hurdles that we have to get over, and the first one is the sample prep. The sample prep is important, but one of the best samples that you can use is urine. It is clean. It's, you know, non-invasive. You just collect it in a cup and hand it over. We can get proteins like the HCG, the pregnancy hormone, is found in urine. Drugs collect and can be found in urine. And they're really, you know, pretty straightforward sample. The problem with urine is it's like a reservoir of, sample. So if you are a chronic pot smoker, marijuana is fat soluble. It will, you know, leach out of your fat for maybe up to a month. And so it'll still be in your system. So do you want to know if somebody is, have they smoked pot last night, or is this just part of their chronic use, right? Urine wouldn't be a good sample for that. You'd need blood. So let's talk about blood. Blood requires a lot of sample prep. In the laboratory, you saw those big instruments, and in those instruments we have centrifuges that spin the blood down and separate the components, where you have serum or plasma, it's that yellow hay-looking color on your blood sample and separates that from your red cells. The point of care, you often don't have that. So we have kind of clever technologies to clean up that sample, but any kind of sample prep increases the complexity of the test. And you don't want a point-of-care operator that has no laboratory training pipetting, centrifuging, doing all of these lab functions. You want them to be able to load that sample on the instrument, close the lid, and start. So that's part of the challenge, because the regulatory environment for point-of-care testing increases dramatically the more complex the test is. So it requires more oversight, it requires more specialized training personnel to use the test. So we want to make them as simple as possible, and using a whole blood capillary finger stick would be ideal. The problem with capillary samples, though, you can imagine you start squeezing the finger and milking it, you get a lot of interstitial fluid and you can dilute your sample. Patients who are dehydrated have not as much serum in their whole blood capillary stick, so you can overestimate some of the analytes that you're measuring in a patient with dehydration. So in an urgent care situation, right, if you have a very critical patient, maybe a capillary finger stick isn't the best. You want to be able to use venous blood. The other issue of sample type that we have to worry about is, what's the concentration of that analyte in the blood that you're searching for? Is it something that you have to, that you can just use whole blood and pick it out very easily because it's in a high enough concentration? Or do you have to amplify the signal? So in micro, what they do is they'll, you know, swab an area, let's say your nasal passage, and you plate it out on a plate. You have to actually grow that or culture that bug to be able to identify it and see it. And that takes a lot of time and can't really do that at the point of care. So it's another one of the challenges that we have in point of care. So technology is really important, and John talked about how chemistry is really simple, but to make something so small, simple, and easy to use, that is extremely complex. And so it's very, very difficult to take a glucose that you're doing in the core laboratory in your mega lab and simplify that down to a bedside device that might be the size of this and hand it to a patient and expect them to be able to use it without directions, right? And so a wave test, anybody should be able to pick it up and use it and get the right result. So that is extremely challenging for us, and getting the right sample type, et cetera. So the technology that I'm going to talk about or make an example of today is some molecular applications for point of care. So this is new and exciting stuff. We haven't had an opportunity until recently to be able to do molecular testing at the point of care, which is that really complex stuff that John was talking about, offering this at the bedside. So getting a result in what traditionally would take a few hours to run in a core lab to turning it around in under 20 minutes. So the example I'm going to talk about today is group A strep. Did you know that for every 100 U.S. patients, there are 42 emergency department visits? That, to me, is shocking, but it's the truth. And then the top 20 diagnoses, group A strep is one of the ones for the outpatients. And so it's estimated that, I think it was in 2008, there was an economic survey done that more than $500 million are spent on group A strep treatments and the outcomes. So if the strep is not treated and it impacts children more than adults, can go on to cause a number of issues with the heart and the kidneys. And so we want to be able to identify it quickly and send those patients on their way with treatment and the correct treatment. So we don't want to incorrectly treat them because then we'll have the problem of antibiotic resistance, because the problem with strep as it's presented to a clinician is you often can't tell if it's a bacterial problem or if it's caused by a virus. And so we don't give antibiotics for viruses, but we do need to give them for bacteria. So I'll tell the story of this average guy, John Osiki, with five kids, who goes to the clinic, and John is a microbiologist himself, and he gets swabbed, and they perform a rapid antigen test. So it's a point-of-care test that's an immunoassay, notoriously bad sensitivity, and it's negative. And John's like, I know I have strep. And so the problem with the clinicians knowing what they have is that clinicians often aren't very good at telling the difference between viral and bacterial causes of pharyngitis. So, in fact, it's been studied that they're about 30% accurate. If they don't have any, if they just look on clinical symptoms alone, they're about 30% accurate. So John starts talking to this provider about how he knows he has strep, but the provider's like, look, I don't want to give antibiotic, you know, contribute to antibiotic resistance, so I'm going to hold off and we're going to send your sample away for culture. So John goes home and he's, you know, not happy, but he goes home and he starts infecting all of his family members. And so then his kids are out of school, his, you know, wife's out of work, and it turns out that the culture comes back positive. So the problem with that test was it wasn't sensitive enough to detect John's issue, but he had to wait 48 hours or more for his results because that's the traditional pathway. These tests have great specificity, so once it's positive, you can go ahead and treat right away. But if it's negative, which is the majority of the cases, the prevalence of strep is, you know, anywhere from 20 to 30%, you know, most of what you're testing is negative anyway. So it would be great to know in faster than 48 hours so that you can get the right treatment. And once you're on treatment, then you can become less infective to your family members. So this is what this slide is showing. Essentially, you I have to get a little closer to read it. You have to, the patient has to spend days or hours wondering what's going on with their test result. It requires patient follow-up, right? If you do a culture, you send it away, you have to call them back. And then using unnecessary medications, and this basically impacts the overall cost of care. So if you had a true point-of-care test, which is very different than what happens in the lab you're sending your samples on, which takes you know, hours or days for the turnaround time, some instruments, or what we call the random access instruments that you can place at the point of care, they still take hours. They're not ideal. It's basically putting a smaller lab instrument at the site of care. But a true point of care test not only meets the high sensitivity and specificity requirements that are lab-like, so that you have that accuracy, you have great turnaround time in minutes, and the results can be done at the time of the patient care, so right at the point of care. And so an example of how this impacts that is for the clinical management is with just the clinical assessment you have groups of patients, some that you're going to give antivirals, some that you're going to give antibiotics, and some you're just going to say, you know what, just go home, take some fluids, and rest. But when you have access to objective data rapidly at the point of care, you can see that you might change your mind on who's getting the antibiotics, who's getting the antivirals, and then some of those patients will obviously stay the same. So these tests really can change the way that we manage patients by providing accurate, rapid results at the point of care. And so this reminds me a little bit of when I was helping my parents clean out their garage. And we found this old rotary phone. It had a picture of me in the center of it. And, you know, we used to have to go to the house to make the phone call. And now we have, if you look at my husband's phone, he also has pictures of his kids on the phone because my parents were great innovators to be able to put that picture on the rotary phone. But we have now more decentralized communication. So everybody has access to communicate whenever they need to because they have it in their pocket. And so we're moving more towards that role for patients to be empowered with their own health care and kind of thinking of the Star Trek tricorder idea. Pretty soon you're going to be able to have your pocket genome and be able to go anywhere and get any kind of test and, you know, diagnose yourself. So point-of-care testing has come a long way, and we have a great future. And so now I'm going to introduce Sarah, who's going to talk about maybe some of those opportunities with sequencing. So thanks so much for your attention.
Thanks, Corinne. Okay, so what if I walk up here now and tell you all you can live until you're 120 years old. Okay. Currently today, we spend about $160 billion on medications that are ineffective. That's just ineffective spend. What if I tell you that we can change that? How about if we can scan cells in our bodies, look for a problem within that cell, and tailor-make a drug specific for that molecular signature, whatever it might be, some kind of tag that's specific and unique to us, to our specific disease. Give that drug, cure the disease, or monitor the drug to see if it's working properly, change the drug, and eventually eliminate the disease. What if I tell you today that that is becoming a reality? Right now, we're at a pivotal point in medicine, started at the sequencing of the human genome, but we're at the point now where we're able to do precision, personalized medicine, okay? And it's changing the way that we manage patients. And I think all of this really began, if we go back in time, just a little bit, just 14 years. It's been 14 years since we sequenced the human genome, okay? Back then, 2000, 2003 was when it was published, Bill Clinton said that this is a revolutionary breakthrough. This can change the way that we diagnose, treat, and monitor, and change healthcare and disease. Okay, but we all know that the real acid test of whether a technology is impactful to society and whether it changes and helps human evolution is at some point whether we can trace the development of that technology or discovery back to somebody's garage. Okay? So Apple, okay, we're talking about this guy. What I can tell you is that the sequencing of the human genome can be traced back to this guy's garage. This is Dr. Jim Kent, and he was a graduate student right at the time when the race was happening between industry and the private sector. So we had Craig Venter and we had Francis Collins, and they were going head-to-head in a race to try and sequence the human genome. Using very, very clunky equipment, breaking the genome up into tiny pieces, okay, sequencing each one of those individually, multiple copies of those, and then that part was fairly easy, even though that was difficult and took a very long time. The challenge was, how do you stitch all of those little pieces of sequence together into the genome? And we're talking about 3 billion base pairs here. Okay, so if you take the cell, a human cell, and you take the strand of the DNA end to end and draw it out, it's about 3 meters long. Putting that into perspective, if we magnify the nucleus of a cell 1,000 times, it's about half a centimeter at that point. And then we stretch out all the DNA. It will go from the Lincoln Memorial to the Capitol. Okay, it's that long. And all the DNA in the human body, if you stretch it out end to end, will go to the sun and back 70 times. So it's a lot of DNA. We're talking about a lot of base pairs. This guy, his job was to beat industry to compiling the human genome into a form that could be useful and usable, and to prevent, basically, the opportunity of patents restricting information to the public. Okay, so he set out with David Hausler, UC Santa Cruz, to try and do this. And this was back when I was in grad school. He was a colleague of mine, and this was his PhD thesis, compiling the human genome. He's a genius, as you can tell by his beard. So Jim, back then, computers, I mean, I remember, I think, about 500 kilobytes, gigabytes, right? That was huge. Jim took a bunch of computers and made a daisy chain of them in his garage in Seabright, Santa Cruz. Each computer probably a little bit less powerful than your iPhone in your pocket. And he sat down, taped up all of his arms, put ice on them, and for 3 weeks, nonstop, he wrote 10,000 lines of code to compile the human genome. He created what's called a hungry algorithm to stitch everything together as best he possibly could, and then to refine it as it went along. And sure enough, 3 days before the private sector published theirs, academia published the human genome, made it available, and on the 7th of July, 2003, it was downloadable. Okay? So what is the impact of this? Now, that was then. So this is a graph that shows the white line here is Moore's law, which you've probably heard of. It's basically Moore predicted that the number of transistors that can be put on a chip basically double each year. So this is what it looks like in terms of cost. Now, the human genome, cost of sequencing of human genome has dropped dramatically since the sequencing of the human genome way back in the early 2000, where it cost $100 million, okay? It was actually a lot more than that for the entire human genome project. Down now into 2015, 16, 17, where the $1,000 genome is a reality. Now, the driving force behind that is not just competition between people sequencing, but it's innovations in the sequencing technology and the platform itself. So there were ABI sequencers, fairly clunky, in the early 2000s. By 2005, these next-generation sequencing platforms were developed, massively parallel. So you take the genome and sequence lots and lots of strands, put those all together and look for differences within strands, and so you can determine where mutations are. That's it in a nutshell, really. It's complicated technology. So 454 was invented in 2006. And then as you go along, you see a big drop in the cost. Hit really in 2011, where Illumina launched their first platform. Well, their first platform was in 2009. 2011, they came out with MiSeq. Okay, and that's you've probably all heard of this particular technology. Now, where are we heading now? So there's been generations of next-gen sequencing platforms that have innovated the way that we can do this. They can make it faster, cheaper, and a shorter amount of time to turn around to result. First generation platforms shown here, the second generation platforms are what are routinely used today, and sometimes in clinical testing as well, right? So we've got the Illumina platform, the Ion Torrent, some of these names you've probably heard of, 454. 454 can give you about 700 base pair reads. You know, a base pair, you know about ACTG, everyone's seen CSI and Jurassic Park. Illumina, we can sequence up to about 50 to 300 base pair reads. Can take about 3 days from beginning to end of sequencing to get the results that you're looking for. But now we're moving into third and fourth generation technologies, and these are getting more and more simple. So those technologies rely on amplification. Okay, and then heavily rely upon the software to analyze all the different amplified strands that you've created and looking for differences in those strands to determine which ones are actually real and which ones aren't, so you can find out where the mutations are. Now, the Genia platform is very innovative. It removes the need for all of this complex analytics in terms of amplification, fluidics, all of those things that are, make those other instruments quite complicated. And it relies on a very simple concept, and that's a nanopore. It's kind of illustrated here. It looks a little complicated, but it's basically a membrane with a pore in it. And then on the pore is attached the enzyme or the protein that replicates DNA. And that DNA comes along, attaches to that protein, and then all the building blocks for the next strand of DNA are added by that particular protein. And those building blocks have a tag on them. And the tag is different for each building block, ACTG. And the tag, as it comes along, will block the pore and prevent the flow of a signal. And that's measured very, very precisely. Okay? So this is now single molecule sequencing. There's no amplification involved, no PCR involved at all in this process. The potential of this particular technology is to now be able to sequence up to 20 kilobyte reads. So we're going from 700 to 20 kilobytes, potentially in just 30 minutes. Now, the overall goal of this kind of technology is where the field has been driving towards a $1,000 genome, the $1,000 genome, is to make it a $100 genome. Okay, that's the goal. Now, I don't want you to walk away thinking sequencing is super easy. We just need a box and a bit of chemistry, and here we go. It's actually quite a complicated process, which is why it makes it quite challenging in the clinical setting to use it routinely, to do diagnostics consistently. This is just an illustration of the kind of steps and the different different molecules, basically, that are involved in the whole sequencing pipeline. And each one of these needs to be standardized and very, very robust so that the sample that you put in at one end gives you a very good, robust result that's accurate at the other end. So the goal of this particular pipeline is sample in, result out, very little hands-on, highly reliable. That's the ideal scenario, right? So what is the impact of this kind of technology on human disease? I'm not going to show you any pictures of cancer, but I'm going to be talking about cancer today. And what if I told you that cancer, maybe we can make cancer a chronic disease? This is an example. This is a graph of overall survival for a subset of patients that have lung cancer, a very specific type of lung cancer called non-small cell lung carcinoma. Okay. Back in 1976, the method for treating this kind of cancer was to use chemotherapy. Everybody gets the drug, and hopefully they'll respond. And as you can see, the overall survival was very grim. We're looking between 5 and 6 months at late-stage diagnosis. Now, in 2002, we start to refine some of these chemotherapies. They become a little bit more effective. And then in 2006, there are targeted therapies available that target molecules that stimulate the vascular system. Now, tumors also need a blood supply, just like the rest of our body. And if you can stifle that blood supply, maybe you can kill the tumor. Okay, so it's a targeted therapy, but again, it was given to everybody. So we see kind of a bit of an increase in overall survival. It's significant, but still a very long way to go. Now, right at the time when these clinical trials were being run, when the data came out in 2006, there was a clinical trial being run in China where they were looking at what's called a TKI, tyrosine kinase inhibitor. What this does is target a growth receptor, okay, on the surface of cells. That receptor sends a signal into the cell that tells it to grow and proliferate and divide. It's basically what cancer is. It's a tumor that, where cells are out of control. They're growing and proliferating and dividing beyond the homeostatic mechanisms of the body. So if you can hit the cells with this particular inhibitor, maybe you can reduce the cancer and stop the cancer. Now, what Lynch noticed, Dr. Lynch, noticed from this clinical trial in China is that some people had dramatic responses to the drug, where they would clear all of the tumors within their lungs, whereas others, no response at all, wasn't really helping in any way. He thought this was very curious. Now, we also, in 2004, had the benefit of access to the human genome. Okay, it had just been published. And he thought maybe, he took that leap, that smart leap, that maybe there is something about the molecular signature of the growth factor receptor that's being targeted by the drug that's different in the patients that are responding versus those that aren't. So he went back and he sequenced the receptors in these patients, and sure enough, that's exactly what he found. He found very specific mutations within the receptor that sensitized patients to the drug. And the patients that didn't have those mutations didn't respond. Now, there was another subset of patients that had a different kind of mutation that created resistance to the drug. That's something we'll talk about in a minute. Now, what you can see in 2009 is selection. Now we're selecting patients that specifically have that mutation that sensitizes them to the drug, and we only give that drug to those patients, and you can see huge increase in overall survival. That is precision medicine. This is in non-small cell lung carcinoma, but at the same time, this was happening in another disease state, right? So by 2011, which is really kind of the pivotal point where we realized that precision medicine was going to take off in a big way, there was co-development of a drug for melanoma and the diagnostic. And the FDA approved both at the same time and coined a new phrase, companion diagnostic. Okay, and this was for another factor that drives cell proliferation and division. It's called BRAF. It's a marker, a mutation. So while all this was happening, the director of the NIH got together with the National Research Council and asked them to form an ad hoc committee to start planning a roadmap towards a new taxonomy of disease. Because for the last 100 years, we've looked at cancer and diseases such as that on a cellular level. So it's been defined by looking down a microscope, looking at the shapes of cells, looking at how cells lie, the outlines of them, histology, basically. So going back to non-small cell lung carcinoma, back in the 80s and the dark ages of medicine in the 1990s, not much was known about the signatures. So we'd look down and say, okay, this is adenocarcinoma or squamous cell carcinoma or large cell carcinoma. It's always all that was known. Now there's a vast array of different signatures that have been identified within different cancer types. So we no longer call it lung cancer. Now maybe we're heading into an era where we have non-small cell lung carcinoma that's BRAF negative, EGFR negative, ROS negative, ALK negative, MEK1 positive, right? It's just a molecular signature. And that can then define how we develop drugs and how we treat drugs, how we use drugs to treat those particular patients. So on this committee, Sue Desmond-Hellman and Charles Sawyer were co-chairing the committee and developed this roadmap towards a new taxonomy of disease. So as you can see from sequencing, we've gotten to the point now where we're able to select patients very specifically. We're at the brink of that. It's expanding into a lot of different disease states. But not only are we changing the taxonomy of disease, but we're changing the way we do clinical trials as well. So back in the day, you probably know about phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trials. They're incredibly expensive. 9 out of 10 of them fail. It's billions of dollars. Companies can rise and fall based upon the outcomes of a phase three early clinical trial, right? Now, if we're looking at very specific markers and very specific drugs for those markers, we're probably looking at a really small population. So statistically, it's really hard to do a very large phase three clinical trial. How do we bring drugs to market? Now, the FDA has gone through transformations with how they allow clinical trials to be designed because of this. I think one of the really innovative ways to be able to bring targeted therapies to market is through these rolling, adaptive phase two clinical trials. It's basically a trial where you have a particular protocol. Patients can come into the trial. They present with a certain biomarker. They're given a drug. And if the drug works, then that's great, and we learn from that. If the drug doesn't work, then that drug drops out, you know, based on how many people are efficacious. So we learn through the trial, and it never ends. It just patients keep enrolling, and we try new drugs within the trial. There's other methods, too, umbrella trials and basket trials. There are different ways of including patients in clinical trials, instead of looking at a lung cancer, now we look at patients with a particular biomarker in a particular cancer, or all different kinds of cancers with just one biomarker. So they're biomarker-driven clinical trials. One of the challenges still faced by being able to select patients effectively to receive drugs is being able to get enough tissue to be able to test sequence either by point mutation or through this sequencing technology to look for molecular signatures. It's really difficult. Some of the patients, for example, non-small cell lung carcinoma patients are often only diagnosed at very late stage. They've got metastatic cancer at this point. And sometimes undergoing surgery is not going to be an option for them. So how do we link more patients to care? And I think this is where we're sort of heading into the era of, sequencing in of itself is somewhat science fiction. But now liquid biopsy, this is the next phase, okay, of medicine. Back in 2015, MIT's published their breakthrough technologies, right? They published their top 10 breakthrough technologies each year. Liquid biopsy was one of those, and they called it the molecular stethoscope of the future. So what is it? Basically, the ability to be able to take a blood draw and either by using a targeted method or a sequencing method, determine what kind of mutations are present in the cancer that the patient might have. Okay. Now, this is because your blood system is basically the garbage disposal of your body. Cells are dying and shedding DNA into the blood system, there's a lot of broken pieces of DNA that are traveling through the vasculature. Tumors themselves undergo necrosis or apoptosis and also shed DNA into the system. So you've got your normal wild-type DNA from your regular cells combined with your tumor DNA. And some of that tumor DNA might have a mutation that a drug has been developed to that could cure that cancer. Can we identify that? Well, it turns out that we now have technologies that can do this. So one of the first FDA-approved assays for liquid biopsy was approved early last year. And it does just that. Take a blood draw, okay, extract the target from the blood draw, amplify that target up and detect where the mutation is. And if the mutation is present, patients are then eligible to receive the therapy. One example. Oh, we're going the wrong way. And I think this really leads us into a new era of diagnostics, where you have the power of sampling, new methods of sampling, and the power of genomics combined that can really change the shape of how we manage patients. And this brings me back to the beginning of, can we make cancer a chronic disease? Okay, maybe we're not going to cure it, but maybe we can make it a chronic disease in the same way as we do HIV, where patients now who have HIV positive, you can expect to have average lifespan similar to a healthy person, okay, because there's cocktails of drugs that are available, and the patients are monitored consistently for resistance to those drugs, and those drugs can be changed out and suppress the disease for very long periods of time. Maybe we can do that with cancer, and here's an example of how we could do that. By either using tissue or liquid biopsy. So the tissue sample can be taken from a tumor, and we can use our sequencing technology platforms to look at the molecular signatures within that tumor to look for mutations. Okay, so you'll get basically a genetic profile of the tumor where you can look for, hey, there's a mutation there that I have a drug target for. Okay. And then the patient will start taking the drug. And maybe the patient goes in every 3 weeks and has a blood draw taken. And the blood draw is monitored, okay, for a particular biomarker. You want to see the biomarkers that are driving disease drop. Okay, that's an indication that the disease is being managed by the drug. And then, of course, that's in combination with other imaging technologies like PET scans and such. Now, one of the challenges with these kind of inhibitors is resistance mutations can arise, okay? As John mentioned, bacteria like to find a way to live, so do cancer cells. They'll break free from this inhibition. So then these single biomarker assays can be used to look for resistance mutations, okay? So when a patient is progressing, Maybe we can take liquid biopsies and do additional molecular profiling and see, okay, what is it that's making this tumor break free from the inhibition? Identify what the new target is, design new drugs to that target, and then keep the patient suppressed. And I think this is really the future of where we're going with cancer. It's been predicted that maybe we can make cancer a chronic disease, or at least some cancers a chronic disease, by 2025. So I'm going to leave that with you and invite my colleagues up for questions. Thanks so much.
So we'll go ahead and take any questions. I think we have a microphone. We are recording the discussion, so if we could get you to speak into the mic, that'd be helpful.
Excellent presentation. Lots of questions, but I'll just start with one. I want to go back to the point of care testing. It seems to me that the first wave of those will be a screening type of test,
okay.
Not quantification of anything, but... would you agree that that's the way?
So they're both exist. There are tests that do monitoring of chronic diseases, right? So you can measure the patient's glucose, right? That's quantitative. And then the tests that we have for molecular right now, a lot of them are qualitative. So used to screen patients for flu and strep, but you know, they can be both. We have available point-of-care cardiac marker testing, so used in the emergency department, which is quantitative assessment of their cardiac biomarker troponin, which gets released when the myocytes die during a cardiac arrest. So they're screening, they're diagnostic. So, you know, some of them are, you know, can diagnose an MI. It's a variety of different tests.
And one for all three of you. What are the regulatory and reimbursement challenges that all of this technology you're describing they're faced?
That's a good question. I'll speak to the SmartIcles technology. This is a phenotypic test that can tell us whether or not bacteria are resistant, to specific antibiotics. And it's a new method. It doesn't exist. And so we use CPT codes, and there's reimbursement established for typical laboratory procedures. But with new technologies, we have to petition to have new ones created, right? We're investing in these technologies to be able to bring these into the clinical space, and we don't currently have the appropriate coding. So that's something that we invest time and energy in to explore and establish.
And one of the ways we do that is to help generate the literature. So we collaborate with people outside of industry to do studies to get upswell or sort of a groundswell of scientific evidence that shows that these technologies are helpful. And then that way the guidelines then can change, the scientific guidelines that are written by other organizations to help, you know, government payers and also private payers decide, you know, what technology they think is appropriate for the patients.
And I will scratch the surface of that one and talk about sequencing. If we think of PCR technology, it took about 20 years from the first development of PCR to it being used for routine clinical testing. For sequencing, it took 5 years. Okay, so there was a massive amount of interest and excitement about the sequencing of the human genome and the power that these kind of technologies could release for the medical field. And I think the regulatory environment fell behind that. And so there was kind of a vast well of lab-developed testing in the oncology setting. I think that some of the brakes have been put on a little bit, and some restrictions from the FDA have been wanting to slow the process down a little bit and show more clinical data, more validation in a clinical setting for some of these technologies. Hence the companion diagnostic label that they created. They want to show... they want researchers and manufacturers to show very rigorous data for the effectiveness and safety of the devices in accurately selecting patients to receive drugs. Because you can imagine a disease like cancer, you want to give that patient the best possible opportunity to receive the best possible therapy. And if it just relies on one assay, the sensitivity and specificity of that one assay can determine whether that patient lives or doesn't live. You want the best possible chance. So I think that there's a balance between regulation and the flood and drive for innovation and technology that's really changing the way that we do medicine. It's challenging for industry, for sure, because it takes a long time for diagnostics to get approval, and the field is often moved ahead by the time these things come to market. Yeah.
To that point is the positive predictive value of your diagnostics, and that's the issue that people are paying for bad positive predictive values. The whole industry talks about genetics and molecular diagnostics, but you've got the expression of the protein, you've got the transcription of the DNA, and you've got the mutation of the gene.
Right.
And the problem could be in any of those three layers, but I never hear about expression, transcription. I always hear about mutation. And until you have all three layers incorporated in a test, you're never going to have a positive predictive value that's worth anything, I don't think.
Yeah, that is a really, really important point, and I think spot on, right? We are looking at DNA, which is just a coding piece. There's a lot of steps to go from that code to what actually happens at the cancer level. And I think we're heading into it. This is not going to be the only answer, right? Looking at DNA is definitely not going to be the only answer. And there are assays out there that look at expression. So you've got antibodies that look at tissue for expression of different genes. And I think we're heading into kind of holistic approaches where you're going to have synergy between a lot of different methodologies to determine, what is going on, what's the best way to kind of treat these cancers. One other thing that we didn't talk about is the background of the hosts themselves. Okay, so there's drugs now available that target the host immune system, remove checkpoints, and allow the host to attack, the immune system to attack the tumor. So there's a whole other component of the genetic background of the person themselves, not just the genetics of the tumor. And then, of course, you've got your proteomics and all the rest. So, yes, definitely not to be excluded.
I'm going to ask one last question. So when I was at Roche, which was a decade ago, a lot of the nascent genetic tests and molecular tests and PCR tests were only at the esoteric labs. Have they gotten more prevalent? Are they now more at the reference labs? Are there more of those around the country, across the globe, that are helping to expedite some of the testing?
Yes, most definitely. So molecular assays you will find across the spectrum of labs now, from your small diagnostic labs up to your large reference. PCR is very, very routine, and even next-gen sequencing is becoming quite routine, for better or for worse. It takes a lot of rigorous validation to be really confident in results from current next-gen sequencing technologies. Some are done really, really well, right? But everyone has access to it. And it's relatively straightforward to perform. So, yeah.
And what about the talent pool for those kinds of tests? Are kids coming out of university and our current lab techs and microbiologists and others, are they keeping up with the training that's catching up with all the innovation?
Gosh, that's a really good question. And I think, this is another impact of the sequencing of the human genome. I think we're seeing new programs develop, right? We're shaping education as well. People have to shift and move into other specialties in order to keep up with the way, the speed of scientific progress. I mean, the kind of programs that I did through school, I mean, those are just very, very basic now. It gets more and more complicated. I think we're looking at different specializations. So I think my answer is yes, that's happening.
Great.
Yeah.
Any other questions? There's one more in the back.
What's the average time for a new point of care diagnostic to actually hit the ground? So from the point of you start developing to actually commercializing? And perhaps is the time constraint as much in trying to convince an insurance company that this is a valuable test at the clinic, at the point of care?
It's a great question. So there are a number of different ways tests can come to market, right? From a Roche perspective, we can look at new technologies and people present them to us, and then we can go out and purchase technologies that are really mature. But if you're talking like from the ground level where there's no technology and you're developing that, that can take, you know, a few decades. So by the time that we see a lot of the technologies, they're pretty mature, and some of them actually have even gone to the FDA with some initial small clearances with a small intended use, and then we can take that technology and then commercialize it. So expand it and expand the menu, and then the lifespan of that instrument can go on for several years, right? So this technology, molecular technology, we may start with one or two tests, but then, you know, it could be multiplex, so you can think of all, you know, respiratory virus panels, so that, you know, we right now have just flu, but you can think of, you know, adding other things. We've added RSV to our flu assay. So, you know, and then there are other diseases that you can use with the same platform. So you're expanding that menu. So the actual, you know, definitive answer from when you start to finish, I think it depends on the approach. I don't know if you have another way to look at it.
I was going to say, one example, the Liat system that she spoke of as a point-of-care molecular device, I would say that took about 10 years, I think, from the development stage to actually proof of concept, to show that it works, to get through clinical trials, and then to get it out into the market where people could use it. And what's interesting is that that's not enough to change practice, right? It takes experience. It takes time. It takes health economic studies. It takes direct application in my institution for me to believe in the technology. So it's quite challenging, really, to help people understand. And it's really frustrating for us. We see so many potential applications for this technology. We see how good it is, how robust, how it could save, prevent morbidity in so many different ways if it was just embraced by the medical community.
And the payer, and so they look to guidelines, right? A lot of this, especially the outlying physician practices that don't, you know, that haven't kept up. They're not near a big academic medical center, so they don't have a lot of the new innovative thinkers coming in to try new technologies or doing the clinical trials. They're just out in their practice, you know, isolated. And, you know, to try to get them to adopt these new technologies, they'll turn to a guideline that may have been written in 2012. And if the guidelines can't keep up with the innovations in technology, they're recommending, you know, rapid antigen testing in culture, when we know today that molecular applications far exceed the performance of rapid antigen testing in culture. So, you know, that's what they believe in, and then, you know, to build up those studies takes a little bit of time. So we're working in medical affairs to try to start those collaborations before we bring something to market. But even then, that's a challenge because, you know, we have all these internal issues of when the reagent is ready, how much of the clinical trial is done, what do we think we can manage going forward. So it's a number of different, you know, roadblocks to get something accepted in the clinical community.
So the question was, is an insurance company a part of that? And it's one of the challenges. And I just say, it's part of the critical path to success, right? It's something that we anticipate, we plan for, we educate, we have initiatives, right, to get out there to the payers and help them understand as well, you know, because the trend is to do more with less, and it's getting more and more difficult, right, to recognize the value, the medical value of diagnostic tests. And so that's another thing that we spend a lot of time on, collaborating with colleagues to convey that medical value.
And the diversity across the country, it's amazing, yeah, what gets paid for and covered in some areas and not in others. So that's another challenge that we have. So we do a lot of education, mm-hmm, and supportive education for providers on these technologies, working and collaborating with payers to try to, you know, harmonize some of that across the country so we have equal opportunity for people to receive the same kinds of treatment.
Take us to the future a little bit. Right now we have a shortage of pathologists. Right? You didn't talk much about tissue diagnostic, but a lot of the molecular diagnostic is going to replace looking over a microscope and doing all that. And how do you see that future, that right now regulations require pathologists sign everything, even a molecular test? Take us through that. How will that evolve, you think?
Well, of course, I can't predict. I can only guess. But I think we don't want to remove the professional from the scenario, right? It's going to be very important as we move into next-gen sequencing methods more and more, analyzing that data, interpreting that data, excluding information, including information, that's going to require a professional to translate and then determine what the best course of action for drugs is. So I think there's going to be a very significant need for people with those kind of skills moving forward, and certainly, obviously, pathologists are the likely candidates for that. People with bioinformatics and genetic counseling and an understanding of the kind of the new molecular genetic field, it's going to probably be new specialties that will arise as well moving forwards. But I don't see the professional being removed. I mean, having said that, we are seeing a new wave of direct-to-consumer assays, right? We've seen recently 23andMe getting FDA approval for some of their biomarker testing. So where that's going to go in the future and democratization of medicine is an open book right now. And, of course, you've got regulatory forces that are guiding that forwards. But we have millennials who love to share information. So we'll see how they change the face of medicine as we progress. But I don't see the professional being removed from.
When I started in lab diagnostics, every lab report had to be signed by the lab director. Mm-hmm. That no longer happens. And a lot of it has to do because the instrumentation got better. There was embedded quality control with it. I expect that same will happen here. Mm. You wouldn't have that professional in the point of care testing. I think software is getting better. I think that even Illumina was the first one to use the cloud to do some of the computing. And I think that's going to be more, you think? I see that the professional will take a different role, right? That all of these tests will be more, will assist them, and they won't have to sign anything anymore, but they will. I think generic counselors will be more the types of, but I think the pathologist will take a different role. Yeah.
It's interesting to see where it'll all go. I mean, obviously, big data is kind of where things are at right now, and maybe we're heading away from trying to cure diseases and more into preventative medicine, where we're going to have specialists in wellness, health, and monitoring. But yeah, it's interesting.
Great. Well, please help me thank our panel, John, Corinne, and Sarah. It was a fantastic discussion. We really appreciate you guys working with us. Please note that this conversation will be a podcast. It will be on our website within a few days, as well as the presentation. So you can feel free to share or re-listen and things like that. We want to, again, thank Roche Diagnostics for joining us today, Miles Printing, who is our sponsor, and just want to give you guys a little prep. We've got, I think, at least three other frameworks in process that we'll be letting you guys know about soon, and also our summit will be October 9th and 10th. And we've got some awesome speakers. That won't come out. The registration and agenda won't come out until July, but we've already secured some really cool TED Talk-type speakers. I'm working with Dr. Baduro at Lilly on an awesome scientific session that's going to be expanded because it did so well last year. So look for a lot more information coming from BioCrossroads and some more great content coming soon. Thanks. Sonho meu, no meu céu a estrela guia se perdeu, a madrugada fria só me traz melancolia, sonho meu. Sinto o canto da noite na boca do vento.